The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1 on this week's programme.
The cult of the jazz shop is, I think, affecting very considerably and in a not very pleasant way the disposition of our people.
Jazz and Ireland, how a new form of music clashed with political and cultural institutions in the early 20th century. Also,
he joined a group of VIP hostages that the Nazis had held towards the end of the war in the hope of a possible truce with the British.
The story of John McGrath, the only Irishman imprisoned at Dachau concentration camp during World War II. Plus, The Invincibles, the new book that tells the story of a conspiracy that shook the British Empire in the 1880s. And
the INLA say they assassinated Mr. Neave in pursuit of their long-term objective of getting British troops withdrawn from Northern Ireland.
40 years on, we look back at the assassination of British MP Airey Neave. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. We begin this evening with jazz. At the beginning of the 20th century, the world was witness to a war that brought destruction and loss never before experienced. But it was also witness to a new musical phenomenon, which seemed to arrive just when people needed respite from the devastation of World War I. The jazz craze spread and made its way to Ireland, which at that time, of course, was going through much political change.
While the cultural purists may have perceived that others were guilty of jazzing the soul of the nation away, for those participating in this immensely popular social activity, nationality does not appear to have been at stake.
I'm joined from our Cork studio by Dr. Ruth Stanley, a musician and musicologist who has researched the history of jazz in Ireland in the opening decades of the 20th century.
Well, the earliest known use of jazz as a distinct term in Irish society dates from September 1918, when a small notice appeared in the Belfast newsletter advertising tuition in Belfast in the latest dances, including the jazz. And 4 days later, the Freeman's Journal published a separate advertisement in Dublin for dance tuition in the American jazz. So jazz was primarily perceived as a dance genre in Ireland.
On New Year's Eve, 1918, a victory ball was hosted in Dublin Castle to celebrate the triumph of the Allied forces in World War I. A representative was present from every Irish regiment, and the music and entertainment included a jazz band from the US Naval Air Station in Wexford.
The Evening Herald reports that the combination was conducted by Petty Officer Gordon and played, quote, the raggy stuff with characteristic verve. Notably, the correspondent perceived jazz primarily as a dance craze, with the jazz fever appealing to both young and old. A female dance instructor was interviewed, and she stated that the dance step known as the jazz roll was surpassing the craze for tango. She said the steps are gliding, serpentine-like, with a rolling movement to the shoulders. It's a languid sort of dance and not at all tiring to do. This fact explains why so many badly wounded men and shell shock cases are to be found amongst the jazzers and jazz pupils.
In the years that followed, the unrest caused by the War of Independence and the Civil War discouraged touring jazz bands from visiting Ireland.
In these years, in 1919, the Southern Syncopated Orchestra and the original Dixieland Jazz Band travelled to mainland Britain, but they didn't come to Ireland at that time. Even so, jazz continued to evolve in Ireland in spite of adversity, with a notable increase in the number of local jazz bands providing accompaniment for the ubiquitously popular pastime of dancing. So newspapers advertise miscellaneous bands in counties Carlow, Cork, Fermanagh, Galway, Tipperary, Waterford and Westmeath, not to mention Dublin and Belfast, and I suspect in time, my research will show that most, if not all, of the 32 counties had jazz bands during this period.
One case before the courts in late 1919 exposes some of the tensions in Irish society at the time. Newspapers reported on court hearings involving James Parnell Mandeville, who was applying for a dancing licence at 35 Dawson Street in Dublin.
Mandeville was a prominent Anglo-Irishman who was based in Annercastle in Clonmel. He'd served in the Navy in World War I. Three other members of his jazz band had also served through the war, which, according to Mandeville, quote, might account for the bitter opposition being made to his application. There were also racial objections to his band. Two of his band members were black musicians from London, and a local dance band musician in Dublin, John Clark Barry, declared, quote, the distortions introduced by the coloured members make the music vulgar, exaggerated jazz music is most decidedly suggestive and indecent. And aside from all of this, Mandeville's jazz band experienced objections from the Irish Vigilance Association. A representative there declared that, quote, the jazz has been hunted out of decent ballrooms in Paris and London and should not be tolerated in Dublin.
So jazz was even at this stage falling foul of the anti-enjoyment brigade, I suppose you'd call them.
Yes, and this wasn't exclusive to Ireland, to be fair. This was very typical of the response in America, in Britain and Europe. Newspapers revealed that there was a steady stream of jazz bands touring throughout Ireland and Northern Ireland during the 20s and 30s. So from 1926 to 1930, the American musician Noble Sissel was a regular visitor to Dublin and Belfast. The warmth of his reception among Irish audiences led Sissel to quip that he felt like calling himself Noble O'Sissel.
In Ireland, political and cultural nationalism went hand in hand, and as Gaelic culture was revitalised, there was a suspicion and increasing rejection of any new cultural imports,
including cinema, music hall and jazz. And notwithstanding the American roots of much of this popular entertainment, it is striking that critics frequently blamed Great Britain for its propagation, and such an oversimplification was frankly convenient within an Irish-Ireland ideology that promoted political, economic and cultural independence from British imperialism.
Nowadays, the notion of politicians getting involved in a form of music seems absolutely absurd. But in a newly independent Ireland, the jazz craze didn't go unnoticed in government circles.
And there are quite a few discussions that appear in the Doyle debates. For example, the Fianna Fáil politician Sean T. O'Kelly, during a debate in 1933, said, "The cult of the jazz shop is, I think, affecting very considerably and in a not very pleasant way the disposition of our people."
There were also stern remarks from the bench from a District Justice Gough, who made a fairly dramatic statement.
Justice Gough was very well known for his vociferous opinions at the time on many moral matters and in relation to jazz, and he spoke about jazz quite frequently. He said, "I'm afraid that the influence of this jazz dancing and the influence of the cinema have been very bad. They have made a terrible number of people abnormal, and these people, whom I might call jazz addicts, have lost control of themselves. In fact, you will see them on the streets, in the railway carriages and on the tramway cars, and they cannot keep quiet. Their bodies are being moved about and are swaying to some imaginary jazz rhythm." But Justice Gough held a lot of power because he was involved in granting dancing licences, so his opinions mattered.
Radio, of course, played an important role in spreading the popularity of jazz, though it may have been easier to get a record played on the BBC than on Radio Éireann.
So the BBC was largely an independent enterprise, while Irish Radio, or Radio Éireann, was established as a state service under direct control of the Irish Post Office, which meant that the government had more say in what was being broadcast. In spite of much resistance towards jazz broadcasts on Radio Éireann, there was never a formal ban, though the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, PJ Little, would place severe restrictions on broadcasts of swing, jive, hot jazz and crooning during the 1940s. And going back to the opinions of politicians, it's important to state here there's not a real consensus. Notwithstanding some of the more conservative viewpoints, there was a notable lack of consensus among politicians, the more liberal of whom resisted any authoritarian approach to broadcasting. And I can quote here the Fine Gael politician James Dillon, who condemned Minister Little for his attempts to control music broadcasts on Radio Éireann.
Despite the hand-wringing, a steady stream of jazz bands toured Ireland north and south throughout the 1920s and 30s. But the objections continued from many sides, and chief among them were the Church, the Gaelic League, and the GAA.
And the height of the anti-jazz crusade, of course, was in 1934. For Gaelic revivalists, it was reprehensible to uphold Gaelic values on the one hand while supporting British imported culture on the other. And there was considerable control exerted to preserve the alleged purity of Gaelic culture, as exemplified in the Gaelic Athletic Association's famous prohibition on playing or even being a spectator of what they termed foreign games. What's not so well known is that the GAA also sought to prohibit its members' clubs from hosting so-called foreign dances at GAA functions. But in practice, there was a striking degree of non-compliance by its members, and the GAA was unable to enforce the ruling across the island. So at the Ulster Council's convention of the GAA in 1930, one delegate averred that he preferred, quote, a man who goes to Irish dances and plays soccer to the man who plays Gaelic football and goes to jazz dances. Jazz dances are the hallmark of shoneyism. And it really was an indication of the pervasiveness of jazz dancing in Irish and Northern Irish society that such a conservative institution as the GAA failed to suppress the activity within its own ranks.
And of course, eventually it was supplanted by the even more evil rock and roll. Ruth Stanley, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening to talk about your research on the history of jazz in Ireland.
Thank you.
And next we turn to the subject of World War II and the story of the only Irish person who was imprisoned at the dreaded Dachau concentration camp. John McGrath, originally from Roscommon, was a British Army colonel. He was part of a group of 160 Nazi hostages that Himmler and other SS leaders attempted to use as barter to save the regime, or as a final resort to save themselves. Tom Wald is the author of the new book Dachau to the Dolomites, which tells the story of these hostages and what happened to them as the war drew to a close. In this piece, he talks to reporter Mark Menneman.
In Dachau concentration camp in Germany, there stands a memorial to all those who were imprisoned there. A small detail on that memorial led author Tom Wall on a journey that culminated in the writing of his new book, From Dachau to the Dolomites.
I was visiting Munich a weekend break some years ago, and I went to Dachau just as a visitor, and I noticed there's a map on the wall of the visitor centre there, which enumerates the number of people from each country in Europe who were prisoner in Dachau, and it had one on the map of Ireland, so this intrigued me. And I couldn't find out there who that person was, but I did find out when I came home. In fact, it had been published around the same time in an internet site called Come Here to Me. So I went in search of Colonel John McGrath, found a man who knew him in Roscommon, where he's from, and it took off from there, really.
While John McGrath's career was defined by its time in the military, his career actually began in the theatre.
And I found that not only was he an interesting character, being the manager of the Theatre Royal before leaving to join the war, but that he joined a group of VIP hostages that the Nazis had held towards the end of the war in the hope of starting a conversation about a possible truce with the British.
Many of those detained alongside McGrath were a famous origin.
It was a group of pretty prominent statesmen, clergymen, aristocrats, and former military leaders. It encompassed 17 countries, or 18 countries if you include Ireland. The more notable characters would have been Léon Blum, the former Premier of France, and Kurt Schuschnigg, the former Chancellor of Austria before the Anschluss. But also Stalin's son by his first marriage.
McGrath had a very special role within the British Army, thus making him a person of great interest to the Germans.
McGrath was an ordinary officer prisoner of war in a camp near Salzburg, in the Offlag officer's camp he was detained in. But he volunteered to head up a camp for Irish soldiers whom the Germans had hoped would turn and work for the Germans. Now, he did this voluntarily, but it was at the urging of some of his fellow officers, senior officers. And It was for the reason that they wanted to find out what was going on, and they wanted him to train some of the inmates in codes they could use in letters home that might disclose some of what was going on. So he effectively went pretending to be a possible collaborator, but in fact working to undermine the scheme.
During his incarceration, McGrath was treated very badly by his captors, and often he was tortured.
McGrath, for reasons that are complicated, was discovered as an intriguer against the Abwehr, who were the German military intelligence who ran the camp. He was arrested, treated severely, taken to Sachsenhausen camp, possibly was in danger of being executed because he had smuggled out a document about the numbers in the camp and their names who were working for the Germans, and got a priest who had acted as chaplain for a while to get it to Italy and later to Britain and Ireland. They didn't know the contents of the document, but they knew it was there through tap telephone calls, I think, on the Irish embassy.
McGrath eventually survived the war after an arduous march through the Dolomites, something that Tom describes at great length in the book.
He survived it all through a journey, an odyssey, into the Alps, where dramatic events happened before they were liberated by the Americans.
Unfortunately, John McGrath was haunted by his experience of the war, and it was sadly something that never left him.
He was restored to his job as manager at Theatre Royal, but he wasn't a well man, both mentally and physically, and he retired due to a nervous disorder, and he died within a year and a half of being restored to Dublin.
And that report was from Mark MacMenamin. Sorry, Mark, I left out the Mac in the introduction. And he was speaking to author Tom Wall about the amazing story of John McGrath, the only Irishman recorded as a prisoner at Dachau concentration camp near Munich. And McGrath's story is one aspect of the new book by Tom Wall. It's called Dachau to the Dolomites, the Irishman, Himmler's Special Prisoners and the End of World War II, and that's published by Merrion Press. After the break, we'll be talking about the Irish National Invincibles, the secret assassination squad that formed within the IRB in the 1880s.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your text. And we've had a text in on the subject of jazz in Ireland. Frank in Dublin says, Cabinet Minister Sean McEntee suggested in the Dáil that listening to You're the Cream in My Coffee might not do too much harm. And Frank says, note the qualified nature of the statement from a noted jazz fan who, of course, still had to toe the party line on the issue. And we move from jazz in the 1920s to Ireland in the early 1880s, a powder keg waiting to explode. Famine had begun to grip the country yet again, and farmers were unable to pay exorbitant rents and were being evicted, particularly in the west of Ireland. The Land League was the protector of the tenants, taking on the establishment, and behind the scenes, the secret revolutionary organisation, the IRB, was waiting for its moment to strike. That moment came on the 6th of May, 1882, when an IRB assassination squad, the Invincibles, killed two key political figures involved in British rule in Ireland in the Phoenix Park. And there's a new book about these events. It's called The Invincibles, The Phoenix Park Assassinations and the Conspiracy That Shook an Empire by Dr. Shane Kenna. And to talk about it, I'm joined by two guests. With me in Dublin is historian Micheál O'Divilín, and in our Limerick studio is historian Dr. Ruan O'Donnell, senior lecturer in history at the University of Limerick. You're both very welcome indeed. Now, the reason why we do not have the author of the book in to talk about it is because, sadly, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, the author of this book, Shane Kenna, passed away 2 years ago. Before we talk about how the book actually came about, Ruan, maybe could you just give us a very brief potted version of the events of the 6th of May, 1882? Who were the victims? Who were the perpetrators?
Well, on that very significant day, two of the most senior administrators of the British Empire in Ireland, Frederick Cavendish, who was the Chief Secretary, and Henry Burke, who was the Undersecretary in Dublin Castle, were accosted by, I suppose, an assassination squad of the Irish National Invincibles, a subgroup of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and knifed to death in broad daylight in what was deemed to be a shocking episode. Cavendish and Burke were the most significant victims, I suppose, of Republican assassins for most of the 19th century, and the country was never the same afterwards.
Now, just in relation, Micheál, to the book itself, both you and Ruan knew Shane, you knew his work, a leading historian of 19th century Ireland, particularly when it came to the Fenians. I mean, the War in the Shadows is a book that I have consulted and read more than once. And he was also a biographer of Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa and Thomas McDonagh. How did this book, though, come to be published? How did it come about? Shane hasn't been with us for about 2 years now.
Well, Shane had a huge interest in the Fenians and, indeed, in the Invincibles. I met him when he was working in Camanum Jail as a guide, still a student at that stage. And he told me so much about them, and it was his love of them was so obvious. He wrote a book for my publishing company called The Phoenix Park Assassinations, which is a precursor to this, much, much smaller. There's a lot more information and in-depth analysis in this new book. He was interested in them. He researched them. He looked at them. But more importantly, of course, it was the fact that they were buried in Camanum Jail. So he had every day the opportunity to bring people in, show them where they were buried and tell them the story. And this gave him great pleasure to do until he was stopped.
And was this book pretty much finished before he died?
The book, I believe, was complete. It needed to be edited, of course, and that process was never done in his lifetime. It's been done since. And it's a fine job, I have to say. It's a lovely book and a great book and an easy read, again, which is typical of Shane's work.
Yes, very, very easy indeed to read as an historian. Ruan, that was you gave us a great potted version of what actually happened, but talk to us a little bit about the lead up to that, about the tensions of the 1880s, about how, to some extent, the land war spilled over into something entirely different.
Well, you correctly mentioned there was a Agrarian crisis, in particularly focused on Connacht from around about 1878. And we have to bear in mind, this is a generation who has survived or had just come after on Gorta Mór, the Great Irish Famine, when 1.2 million people at least were put in the ground by with religious services or not. So these are the remnants, these are the survivors, those who have not fled to the cities of the United Kingdom, to Canada, to the United States of America, or Australasia. So the critical thing to understand is the connection between the Irish National Land League, partly founded by an ex-Fenian Michael Davitt, and the revivification of their connections with, I suppose, contemporaneous Irish revolutionaries. Now, this didn't happen overnight, but it involved many, inverted commas, respected politicians such as Charles Sturt Parnell, John Dillon, the leaders of the Home Rule effort, and what became later the nascent Irish Parliamentary Party. So the critical moment, I think, was the 1st of January 1881, when the British government in Ireland used its then Chief Secretary, William Foster, to introduce a coercion act. In other words, to head off this quite successful campaign of focused political violence, mass disobedience, boycotting, resistance to evictions of the poor who were being sent into a position where their lives were threatened by the RIC, the Royal Irish Constabulary. And the decision taken, ironically, and quite interestingly, by one of the facets of this Irish revolutionary diaspora, that in the United Kingdom. So Frank Byrne, Secretary of the Land League in England, sent a close colleague of his, John Walsh, both of whom were Irish Republican Brotherhood members, back to Dublin to organise a system of resisting government coercion. Now, I could say a great deal about this, but in the interest of radio, I'll keep it very short. The two issues were partly counterintelligence and security. In other words, to preserve those active militant elements of the revolutionary movement from British counterinsurgency. And secondly, and let's be clear about this, was infliction and retaliation with a view to dissuading London from acting in a tyrannical factor in Ireland. So this is the origins of the Irish National Invincibles, a group set up in Dublin at the instigation of John Walsh to guard against British tyranny and to basically hold certain office holders directly, personally accountable. Mm. It's very Fenian indeed.
Yeah, but Micheál, to what extent was it an integral part of the IRB? To what extent was it a splinter group which almost split off from the IRB, or was it somewhere in between?
I think it was somewhere in between. They were drawn from the IRB, drawn from the existing nationalists who were acknowledged. I mean, when you look at how it happened, I mean, Walsh met Ed McCafferty, who then introduced him to James Carey, and he went on then to meet Mullet and then Tony Curley, and then they brought their own people in, but they were all drawing from the same pool. So the maximum 50 people in Dublin who were involved were very close-knit group of people who, in one way or the other, knew other people within the group, and they knew what they were capable of. They were selected as an assassination squad.
Would you compare them to Michael Collins' squad of the War of Independence?
Yes. Not that they had committed murder before, as neither indeed in the case of Collins, but they were people who were expected to be able to follow
orders.
Well,
they tried. They tried to kill W.E. Forster, for example, the chief secretary prior to Cavendish.
Oh, they did, but this was after their formation. Mm. They were to follow instructions, follow orders, and to kill people. A difficult thing for anyone to do, so these had to be trusted people. They were selected carefully in order to be able to do this.
Now, the issue of the actual killings themselves, they killed Burke, who was the undersecretary. They also killed Cavendish, who was the chief secretary.
Yeah.
They would have... Burke was definitely the target.
Oh, he was the target.
But Cavendish, was that an accident? Did they even know who they had killed?
It was collateral damage. Burke was a target for two reasons. He was a landlord, and a pretty nasty one. Throwing people off his land, etc., but, you know, evictions. He was also, of course, the undersecretary. He was the permanent undersecretary in Dublin Castle, and he was a Catholic. And you would expect that he would have had some understanding for the Irish cause, but he had none. And it is alleged that, of course, he was imposing Britain's will with relish. So, but Cavendish had only arrived in the country that day. He'd had two functions. One was where he was actually given his official job, and second, he'd been at a dinner in Dublin Castle, and he was walking to his new home now in the Phoenix Park. He knew Dublin
no
well.
No security.
No security. He knew Dublin well. He'd been here before, but, of course, in a less prominent position, and had walked around freely. There was also, of course, always the view that if you had security with you, you were admitting something. Mm. So, no. Now, Inspector Mallon, chief of police, had been there in the park earlier on, was warned that something was happening, and was warned to go away by a policeman who said for his own safety.
Away.
He did go away. He said his shoes hurt,
yeah,
and he went home. Burke was heading out in a carriage, saw Cavendish, got out, and went walking along with him. And yes, it was purely he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm. That was it.
Rowan, it was a particularly brutal assassination. Most Irish assassinations, and there were assassinations during the land war, for example, assassinations of landlords and bailiffs. Most of them were, they used guns, but this was different. This was knives, and it was a particular kind of knife.
Well, that's quite true. And this is something that caused a great deal of public shock, that cutlery normally used in medical practice were employed and indeed imported from the UK and purchased for that very purpose. They did knife other people, incidentally, but not with such deliberate, I suppose, intention. It is important to bear in mind that the knives were not procured to kill Cavendish per se. The knives were procured to kill Forster because he was regarded as a tyrant, and also the viceroy himself, Earl Cowper, who had been under significant surveillance, who normally did move with security, hence the great deal of planning that went into the situation. And if I may just digress for one second and come back to the main point, the day before they were killed, two young bandsmen in Ballinagh, County Mayo, had been shot dead by the RIC when they were welcoming home Charles Stuart Parnell, who'd been released just 3 days earlier, the 2nd of May. Arising from that, Foster and Cowper both resigned, removing from the picture two of the three most desirable targets the Invincibles had. So Cavendish was somewhat unfortunate, but I think it must be said, as Chief Secretary, he was regarded by the Invincibles as fair game, as retaliation. Burke, as Micheál absolutely correctly says, was a particular hate figure because he was regarded as an apostate, politically and otherwise. The execution of this incident was done with clinical ferocity, and it was clearly showed a great deal of orchestration. Two men in front, others across from the side, and at least three from the rear. This is something they have literally rehearsed with a different set of particular targets in mind. And yes, it was shocking. It had the desired effect of reminding the British government that they were not untouchable.
Now, Micheál, what happens after the assassinations? They get away and the investigation begins. And the man you mentioned, Superintendent John Mallon, who would have been in charge of G Division, which was sort of the intelligence unit, if you like, of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, begins an investigation and perhaps investigates more enthusiastically than he, well, certainly with more enthusiasm than he exhibited on the day, on the 6th of May, 1882, for sticking around and seeing what was going to happen.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got to understand how policing worked at the time, particularly detection. It was based primarily on informers. So he went looking for his informers. He found difficulty in getting them, but he very quickly found out who was alleged to have done this. He arrested, maybe 30 people ultimately. They were brought to Kilmainham Jail. They were tried. There were mistrials. There were people being released. There was a lot of trickery going on in the jail, where, unable to break them, he pretended that one was informing by setting up an empty cell opposite to Curley. Yeah. Setting up an empty cell across from him and having people going in and out with notebooks.
Because he was convinced Curley was involved, but he couldn't prove it.
Couldn't prove it.
And then he hoodwinked Curley into
Curley broke. And of course, as usual, once one goes, others will follow.
Sorry, Carey, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Carey was the one who broke. James Carey was the one who broke, thinking that Curley was basically shopping them all.
Yeah.
And Carey then turns up as a state witness and was crucial in all of this, wasn't he?
Yes, he was indeed. He was vital, and of course he was ostracised by the others. They laughed at him, they threatened him, they did, you know. But yes, he was. But there was more than that. There was a young girl, whose name escapes me at the moment, from Drogheda, whom Mallon offered a bribe to. Her fiancé was in jail, and he said he would have him released if she gave certain information, which was false. She refused to do that. She came forward later and announced this. But this was how detection worked. Mm. It was a crooked business at the time, and it was probably on the basis of fighting fire with fire. A lot of these political societies that were relying equally on informers on the inside, information coming out. They were, so it was a case of having to, well, from their point of view, having to fight fire with fire.
And I think, Ruan, for many, many years afterwards, Carey would have been to the south of Ireland what Lundy would be to unionists in the north of Ireland, would he not?
Well, that's a fair point. And part of the poignancy of Carey's fate, having been manipulated by an incredibly able and slightly strange Inspector Mallon, was that he had been one of the most significant centres, in other words, mid-level leaders of Fenians in Dublin. Yeah. He was a very well-known man. He was a public figure. He would have been highly regarded. And the fact that himself and his brother and Miles Kavanagh found themselves manipulated into the worst thing of all, which is giving evidence against former comrades, it was something that shocked people. So when he was assassinated en route to what he hoped would be, I'm sure, an anonymous exile in southern Africa, and accosted by Pat O'Donnell and done to death, Pat O'Donnell emerges from this whole period as probably the single most lamented figure. Even more so than Joe Brady, even more so than Dan Curley, is Pat O'Donnell's prowess in taking out a man at an opportune moment, at almost certain risk of going to the gallows himself, which indeed occurred. He became one of the few martyrs of this rather shocking episode.
Now, what about the involvement or non-involvement or the accusations or allegations of involvement or sympathy or complicity or whatever way you want to put it, of one Charles Stewart Parnell in all of this, Ruan?
Well, that's a terrific question, and you could have a whole show on that one.
You could, and
hope you will someday. But if you take it back, just very briefly, to as far back as 1877, Parnell was in direct contact with leaders of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Clan na Gael, the Irish American Annex, with a strong base in New York City and also Philadelphia, with John O'Leary, with J.J. Kelly, and even the great John Devoy, the New York City-based Titan, who would later become the mentor of Tom Clark. This led to the so-called New Departure, which was an agreement between elements of militant republicanism that there might be ways of advancing the interests of Ireland short of a dynamite campaign, whereas others were advocating precisely such, not least Jeremiah Donovan Rossa, the Brooklyn Dynamite School, and all of that. So Parnell was in touch with the upper leadership of the tendency from which the Irish National Invincibles emerged. It became the role of other British agents, particularly when Home Rule looked like being potentially successful in the rule of Gladstone, the fairly progressive and liberal English Prime Minister, British Prime Minister, of Richard Pigott and the Fenian spy Henry Le Caron, a.k.a. Thomas Beach, to connect Parnell to the killers. Now, Parnell had spoken in Parliament famously, sympathetically, about the Manchester Martyrs of 1867, who had also been killed in an attempt to rescue prisoners, and, you know, there's loss of life. Sergeant Brett was killed in that episode. Parnell had been associated as someone who had dealt in his earliest careers with Patrick Egan, John Martin, and others as associated with not just Young Ireland, but also the 1867 era IRB. Allegedly, and probably, Parnell had joined the IRB around about May-ish of 1882, around the time of the so-called Comenham Treaty, when he was negotiating tentative terms with the Gladstone government. Parnell was, of course, obliged to distance himself from what happened at the Phoenix Park. There's no suggestion of direct agency. To my mind, the Invincibles were people who wanted to push that particular envelope much further than someone like Parnell would ever do, into an independent secular Irish Republic, as declared by the Fenian Brotherhood in 1867, a reiteration of Robert Emmet's proclamation in 1803.
Finally, Micheál, the Invincibles, as you said, they were hanged in Kilmainham Jail. They were buried more or less where they were hanged, and their bodies are still there.
That's right.
There is some talk that the bodies might be transferred to Glasnevin Cemetery.
Well, I sit on a committee at the moment that is attempting to get them removed. I mean, they are there illegally. The jail is closed, so the sentence was completed in 1910, but that ceased to be a jail. And they're being held there. They're not even part of the tour, really, usually. So they're lying idle, lying there, ignored. These, love them or hate them, they deserve not to be ignored. Glasnevin have said they would gladly take the bodies and bury them there, so we're agitating now to have them removed and placed in a grave in Glasnevin.
Rowan O'Donnell and Micheál O'Devlin, thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening on The History Show. The book is The Invincibles, The Phoenix Park Assassinations and the Conspiracy That Shook an Empire. It's published by O'Brien Press, written by the late Dr. Shane Kenna, sadly, as I said, no longer with us, who has definitely left a huge legacy, a valuable legacy in the field of 19th century Irish political history. And we're going to take a short break and we'll be back after these.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. 40 years ago this month, Éireann Eve was murdered in a devastating car bomb attack. The British MP and Margaret Thatcher's Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland was killed by the Irish National Liberation Army, the INLA. To talk about this, I'm joined in studio by Stephen Kelly, Senior Lecturer in Modern History at Liverpool Hope University. Stephen, you're very welcome back to the programme. You've been researching Éireann Eve's life, a multifaceted figure. Indeed, somebody who long before, and let's just talk about the before, first of all, long before he became associated with Margaret Thatcher or Northern Ireland, had quite an amazing life, including an amazing Second World War.
Yes, Éireann Eve was an extraordinary individual, and the more I research on Éireann Eve, the more fascinated I am about his legacy, if you like. He was born in 1916. During the Second World War, he received military honours for his escapades during the events of Calais. He was actually arrested and imprisoned at Calais by the Nazis. extraordinarily was able to escape and then was rearrested, and that's when he was sent to Colditch, the prisoner of war camp, and he also escaped from Colditch. He was the first prisoner of war officer to escape from that particular prison, which at the time was one of the most fortified prisons under the control of the Nazis. It was after he escaped from Colditch, he was returned back to Britain. He was recruited by MI6, and this is where his legacy, if you like, and his connections with Spooks really takes prominence, if you like.
He worked for something called MI9, which I have to say I'd never MI5, yeah, MI6, yeah, MI9, never heard of them before.
They were, if you like, a training organisation to send in operatives back into occupied parts of Europe, and because of his own escapades, he was seen as the ideal person to train individuals to send them across, if you like, across the Channel and back into France and various other parts of occupied Nazi Germany.
And he became then an MP not that many years after the end of World War II, sometime in the 50s, wasn't it?
Yeah, so after the war he's retained by MI6, and then he goes on and takes a role with the Territorial Army, and he's a commanding officer there. It's in 1953 he's elected as a Conservative MP for the constituency of Abington, and he retains that that position, if you like, until his assassination in 1979. So he's a man who's a mixture of kind of association with Spooks, with intelligence services, but also now he's a politician, elected representatives, and it's that kind of duplicity, if you like, of his character and his experiences that makes him quite different to many of his contemporaries.
Now, obviously, during the 60s, for a considerable part of the 60s, Labour would have been in power. But before Labour came into power, was he just an ordinary MP? Would he have had, you know, junior ministerial positions? What was, as a politician, how well known would he have been in the 50s and early 60s?
Very, very well respected in the Conservative Party circles. Under the Ted Heath administration of the late 60s, he did have a junior position. But he fell out with Ted Heath, and he also suffered from poor health, so he had to take a back step in his political career. And for all accounts, his career was almost up at that stage. It's his connection with Margaret Thatcher that's quite extraordinary, because...
Yeah, I mean, she was a huge admirer of Airy. It was, and it was entirely mutual, wasn't it?
Yes, they certainly respected one another, but they were both barristers by profession, so they'd worked together in the law courts. And then by the time Thatcher's stature starts to grow within the Conservative Party, and I'm talking now of the mid-70s, it's Airy Neave who was her election campaign manager. So when Thatcher is successfully elected as Conservative Party leader, Airy Neave is the mastermind. And Thatcher always, would never forgot that. And it was effectively anything that Neave actually wanted after that election victory, Thatcher would have granted.
Now, his interest in Northern Ireland, certainly my assumption would be that his interest in Northern Ireland was very military and that it was all about defeating the IRA and very little else. Is that an unfair characterisation?
It is, but that's the general consensus within the historiography, that Neave was particularly ignorant of political events in Ireland and was solely focused on security. And again, in my own work in the forthcoming book on Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative Party, I actually dispel that argument and say that Neave actually had a great understanding of political events. I suppose it's an important point to also make is that when Neave is appointed shadow spokesman for Northern Ireland in 1975 on the opposition, on his own request, it's an extraordinary request, because Northern Ireland was the graveyard for political ambitions, but Neave wanted it because of his own experiences of the war, if you like, and also his
experience. He asked for
the opposition.
Right.
And Thatcher granted it. And it's from there that Neave starts to develop a kind of political philosophy regarding Northern Ireland. I must say, first and foremost, security was always number one ambition. And he was hell-bent on eradicating Republican terrorists.
Okay, but beyond that, what were his policies? What was he trying to achieve, or what would he have tried to achieve in Northern Ireland, assuming he became Secretary of State for Northern Ireland when the Conservatives took over the government?
Well, besides security policies, he's the central issue for Neave was regarding how Northern Ireland be governed. And under the Labour government, the Conservative Party in the mid-70s, they had a bipartisan policy of restoring devolution, which had fallen apart with Sunndale Agreement and the Ulster Loyalist Strike. Neave makes a significant shift in the late 70s. In 1978, he comes out in favour of Molyneux, who was the leader of the UUP party at the time, of what was known as regional devolution, where it's effectively known as compromise integration, where you would allow county councils in Northern Ireland to take control over issues around rates, setting of housing, sewerage. So the idea was fully fledged devolution wouldn't happen, but neither would integration, because because many hardliners within the Conservative Party were calling for integration, particularly Ian Appel, who at that time was an Ulster Unionist MP, and another individuals within the Conservative Party. So to say that Niamh was just solely security obsessed would be unfair, but he was noteworthy because he spoke about if he did come to office, and this is probably one of the reasons he was assassinated, he would reintroduce the death penalty. And so, and Thatcher supported that, which again, not many people will be aware of. And he also encouraged bringing of more SAS troops into Northern Ireland, a whole brigade. And this is where the issues around shoot to kill policy come to the fore, because that's something that Niamh had seemingly been advocating before it actually became, if you like, a policy.
I mean, all of what you're saying reinforces the notion or the stereotype of the absolute total hardliner and somebody that Republican paramilitaries would see absolutely as a legitimate target, but almost an essential target. So tell us what happened then on the 30th of March 1979.
Well, the events themselves, they're relatively well recorded in the archival documentation and the newspaper reports. So it's the 30th of March 1979. Niamh gets up a normal day, heads to work. The context, I should make the point, is that 2 days earlier, on the 28th of March, that is when the no-confidence vote was carried through and the Callaghan government fell.
So there's going to be an election.
Exactly. And now it's inevitable that Niamh will be appointed Secretary of State for Northern Ireland if the Conservatives win. And that wasn't a guaranteed point at the time. So the decision was made at that time by the INLA that Niamh was a legitimate target. And for several weeks before, they compiled a dossier of Niamh's kind of daily routes and his manoeuvring. So the day he goes to Westminster, as he would, routine, planning for the election that's to come, at about 2:58 p.m. he leaves Westminster to head home to his wife Diana, and it's while leaving the Houses of Parliament, where the cars were parked downstairs, he comes up the stairs, if you like,
up a ramp,
yes, and the device is activated. Now the device was
a two switch
device, one watch and one was a mercury switch. So when you went up the ramp, it activated the mercury and triggered a bomb, which is like 1 kilo of TNT.
Right. Okay, the question I asked you before the break was how come it didn't explode when he was driving in to the House of Commons? And really, there can only be one conclusion.
Yes, so the Home Office and the British establishment to this day would deny this, but the clear reality is that the bomb was planted in the car park, and that was made very clear by the INLA seemingly straight after the event. Now, the Home Office at the time denied this and said the bomb had been planted outside Niamh's home. But again, as you refer to, how did the car then make its way into the car park?
Yeah, it should have blown up on its way in the morning. He wasn't killed instantly.
No, he died within a space of a half an hour, but he did initially survive, and he was brought to Westminster Hospital, but he died on the operating table. And immediately Thatcher was informed of his passing, and by all accounts she cried, and she tried to compose herself, but she was deeply, deeply traumatised by Airy Neave's passing, and that left an indelible imprint on her thinking regarding Northern Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, the effect of the death of Airy Neave would have had a huge influence, or did it must have had a huge influence on Tory party policy and her attitudes to Northern Ireland, didn't it?
Like Neave, up to 1975 and indeed up to 1979, Thatcher gave very little thinking to Northern Ireland. She allowed Neave to take the lead. But after his assassination, and actually when she comes to power in May of 1979, Lord Mountbatten is murdered in August of that year, along with 18 soldiers at Warren Point. And these issues really drive home to Thatcher that we must defeat terrorism, and there's no compromise, there's no negotiations, and this is the framework that you have with the forthcoming hunger strikes, if you like. We will not condone these actions. These are criminals, they are murderers, and they must be treated that way.
But the political agenda that was espoused by Niamh, did that go by the board to some extent because of his murder?
Well, exactly. So the manifesto for the Conservative Party for 1979 advocated what I refer to as devolves, a regional council model. When the Conservative Party come into power in 1979, that's dropped, it's ditched. On the very day she takes office, her Cabinet Secretary, Sir Hunt, says to Thatcher, this is a no-runner. Devolution is the only way forward. You have to set up a power-sharing executive in Northern Ireland because the Unionists and the SDLP need to come and form this form of alliance. And Thatcher says, OK. So she dumps Niamh's legacy, if you like, in Northern Ireland, in terms of political legacy, but she continues his security legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the History Show this evening to talk about the killing of Éirí Níomh in March 1979. And Stephen is the author of a forthcoming book from Bloomsbury Press. It's called Margaret Thatcher, The Conservative Party and the Northern Ireland Conflict 1975, I beg your pardon, to 1990. That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. And in fact, it's all we have time for on this season of The History Show. We will be returning later in the year, September, October, there or thereabouts. And in the meantime, details and podcasts of all our items are available on our website, rte.ie/history. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.